Welcome to Real Conservative Talk. You are now entering an unsafe space.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the RCT podcast again. A couple of housekeeping statements real quick. If you haven't already, go subscribe to the YouTube channel, which is at RCT Network. And also go and subscribe, it's free, to our Substack, which is the RCT Report. And I'll put the link to the Substack in the description for the podcast. And that is where we do all of our writing. We go even further in depth than what we do on the podcast. This is also where you can go and see a lot of the links and the numbers that we talk about on the show so you can get a visual. Because I'm not really here to change anyone's mind. I'm just here to present you the data and the information that I get, that I read about, and then you can go and make your own rational opinion from it. Now, a lot of things we got to talk about today. Two of these stories actually have occurred as of earlier today. And the first one, I think, the biggest one, Trump has been removed from the Illinois ballot. Let me restate that, actually. The judge in Illinois has tried to remove Trump from the Illinois ballot. I have a CNN article here that I'm going to read to you. And it says, in a surprise move, an Illinois judge has removed former President Donald Trump from the state's ballot based on the 14th Amendment so-called insurrection ban. Now, this isn't the first time this has happened with Trump. I believe Maine, Colorado, and Hawaii has tried. And I want to say there was one more state in there somewhere that has also tried to do this. Now, Colorado, and I don't think any state actually has been successful by doing so. Colorado tried it and the U.S. Supreme Court actually shot it down because Trump hasn't been charged with anything. So for you to disqualify him based on insurrection, that means he has to be charged with insurrection, which he is not. So I just wanted to clarify that for people. The decision is paused, giving Trump a short period of time to appeal. It says Wednesday's unexpected decision comes as a similar anti-Trump challenge from Colorado is pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, which is widely expected to reject arguments that Trump is barred from office. It says Cook County Circuit Judge Tracy Porter heavily relied on the prior finding by the Colorado Supreme Court, calling Colorado's rationale compelling. Quote, the court also realizes the magnitude of this decision and its impact on the upcoming primary Illinois elections, Porter wrote. The Illinois State Board of Elections shall remove Donald J. Trump from the ballot for the primary general election on March 19th, 2024, or cause any votes cast for him to be suppressed. I want you to think about this. The Democratic Party, who is supposedly all in favor of enfranchising voters and all against suppressing votes, is literally going to suppress the votes, or going to try to suppress the votes of the people who voluntarily, by the way, voluntarily, not forced, but voluntarily, in a democratic process, choose to cast their vote for an individual. I'm one of these people that I don't care who it is. If people go and cast a vote for someone, then that vote needs to count, as long as they voted legally. I'm not saying that people who are not citizens of the U.S. or aren't legally voting, their vote shouldn't count. But anyone who is legally voting, that is in the United States, if you're 18, and or at least 18, and you're a citizen of the United States, then you should be allowed to cast that vote for whoever the hell you want to. should not be up to any government official who decides whether your vote counts or not. And this is a judge saying this. I want to read this again. This is scary. The Illinois State Board of Elections shall remove Donald J. Trump from the ballot of the general primary election on March 19, 2024, or cause any votes cast for him to be suppressed. Wow. Says the judge stripped Trump from the Illinois ballot 1 month after the anti-Trump challenge was dismissed by the Illinois State Board of Elections. In an unanimous and, I love this, bipartisan vote, the election board tossed the anti-Trump case because it said it didn't have jurisdiction to review the matter. Illinois is now the third state where Trump was booted from the ballot after Colorado and Maine, but those decisions were paused pending the appeal of the Colorado case to the U.S. Supreme Court. So this is where it starts to get a little sketchy, and I actually went and did some research. It says the Illinois challenge was filed by a group of voters in coordination with Free Speech for People, which is a legal advocacy group that previously tried but failed to remove Trump from the ballot in Michigan, Minnesota, and Oregon. So what you have is you have this nonprofit organization that is funded, because I went and actually looked up their tax returns and their funding, which is funded by organizations like the Tides Foundation. The Tides Foundation receives millions of dollars from not just unnamed private donors, but also from labor unions like the AFL-CIO, the NEA. I'm talking about millions of dollars in grants. And they have this web of 501c4s, which is it's an IRS format, basically, which is dictating how they're taxed. And if you have a 501c4, you actually don't have to disclose who's giving you money. And they have this complex web. The Tides Foundation is a far left foundation, by the way. And they have like six different 501c3s, which is your traditional nonprofits that they give money to, and they wash money back and forth. The labor unions are involved in this, and other businesses and companies and corporations are involved in this. It's this very complex web, and they go back and forth with their funding. They're also funding the immigrants coming in. They fund things like asylum seeker help. They fund things like the Hispanic Foundation, who helps a lot of these so-called asylum seekers cross the border. They fund legal representation for the illegal migrants coming across the border. This all comes from these nonprofits, and the Tides Foundation is a major player in this. By the way, they also can receive money from foreign entities and then take that money and spend on behalf of the Democratic Party. People do it for the Republican Party too, but it's way much larger in favor of the Democratic Party now. When it comes to this is your super PACs, this is your dark money pools that you hear about. This is what all this comes from. So you now have this Free Speech for People, and I'll put the link to their website in the description so you can go check this out. Going state to state and filing complaints and lawsuits on behalf of supposed voters to get Trump taken off the ballot in all of these different states. Just one group. So I obviously started thinking to myself, wow, this one nonprofit is going in multiple states and they're the ones that are putting up the money to get Trump taken off the ballot. Who's funding them? That's what led me down this road. And there's a lot of websites you can go check. You have Open Secrets. You have, there's another one I can't, Influence Watch, I think it's called, where you can go and look up a lot of the funding directions that these nonprofits have and who they're getting money from, who they're giving it to. But I like to go directly to the actual filings from these organizations themselves. If it's a labor union, you go look at the LM2 filings every year. If it's a 501c4 or C3, go look at their Form 990s, which is basically their tax returns every year. And you can find all this information directly from the horse's mouth. Now, says at a hearing in late January, Porter pressed Trump's lawyers on the difference between a riot and an insurrection and whether Trump must be first convicted of a crime before he is barred from office. And obviously he does in this circumstance. That's why it's being challenged in the state of Colorado. This is just another way for the Democratic Party, and I hammer the Democratic Party because, like I've said in my writings, in my book and on the Substack, the Democratic Party is the only party that's actually trying to implement laws and make changes that swing elections substantially in their favor. The Republican Party, any laws the Republican Party has put forward as it relates to elections, is actually just trying to maintain how elections are operated, such as making mail-in ballots illegal. Whereas, you know, in recent history, mail-in ballots were used by people who were absent from the state. Someone like myself who goes back and forth, and I'm in Australia, I may have need an absentee ballot so I can vote. That's fine. Or military members, they need an absentee ballot so they can vote. That's fine. You have those special exceptions. The Democrats are the ones who, guess what, made it to where people could vote at will using absentee ballots, so they didn't even have to leave their house. And they did so in the name of protecting people from COVID. But that change overwhelmingly benefited the Democratic Party. They received like over 70% of mail-in ballot votes. So it wasn't to protect people from COVID, because people still went out and got... If it was to protect people from COVID, then they would have done everything in their power to just completely eliminate in-person voting, period. And they didn't. They still allowed it. Now, other changes the Democratic Party has made, if you don't believe me, I have a whole list. You have one, H.R. 51, which they want to make Washington, D.C. a state. Well, Michael, what's that have to do anything with voting? Well, I'll tell you what. If you make D.C. a state, you still have to, by the Constitution, have a federal district that's not a state. That's a separate entity. So what H.R. 51 did, and by the way, this was actually passed with an overwhelming majority in the House. But if you make D.C. a state, they were actually going to shrink the Capitol down to just like a couple blocks. And it's just a couple buildings with, like, I think the Washington Monument, the White House, the Lincoln Memorial or something. Like, I don't know. I've never been there, but it was just a couple blocks there. And everything around it would then be a new state called Washington, whatever, right? Well, if they did that, guess what that does? That gives the new state of Washington, D.C., two senators and one seat in the House of Representatives. So now you would have 102 senators. Those 102 those two senators that state gains would overwhelmingly be in favor of the Democratic Party, because the state of Washington, D.C. would vote upwards of 80 to 90% in favor of the Democratic Party. That's how they vote now when it's just a district. Currently, Washington, D.C. as a district also gets three votes per the 23rd Amendment. So since Washington, D.C. as the federal district gets three votes, whoever is president, if they were to make it a state, that federal district would be shrunk down so much. Basically, the president and his family would be the only residents in the federal district. Therefore, they're the only ones casting votes for the president of the United States. Therefore, the three electoral votes given by the 23rd Amendment would be dictated by the president himself. And these other changes that the Democratic Party are trying to implement, where they can basically have a monopoly on the presidency, would guarantee them, if they were to make DC a state, three electoral votes in the new smaller federal district, because they'd have a Democratic president at that point, as well as three more electoral votes with the new state, because you would gain three votes, which is two senators, one representative, and that's equal to your electoral votes. So they would gain six electoral votes in the presidency. They would gain two senators, which would give them a majority when it comes to the Senate. And they would gain one seat in the House of Representatives, which may or may not benefit them, you know, but it does on the electoral part. Here's another way they try to change it. Number two, mail-in ballot voting, like I already talked about. 2020, they did it in the name of protecting people from COVID, but guess what? They tried to expand that in 2022 when COVID was over. It overwhelmingly benefited the Democratic Party. They could go, they could do ballot harvesting, they could do all kinds of election methods that were very, very sketchy And we saw what happened there. Number three, they try to eliminate voter ID laws. Why? Because then anyone could go and vote, and they knew that people were going to vote in favor of them. Number four, the Democratic Party is the only party to not only introduce, but to pass legislation to allow non-citizens to vote in elections. And I talked about this the other day. New York actually passed legislation. Democratic Party in New York passed legislation to allow non-citizens to vote in their municipal elections. And ironically, they are importing a substantial amount of illegal migrants to New York City. I wonder why. And they're also calling them asylum seekers, which gives them the legal right to work in a lot of cases. And we'll go into that in a second. But thankfully, the New York Supreme Court overturned that legislation that was passed and put into law. Number five, you have H.R. 117, which is the youth voting rights bill that was introduced by Elizabeth Warren. You see, these don't even have to be passed into law. My baseline is this. When a politician puts forward legislation, it benefits said politician in some sort of way, along with the people who support the bill as well. They get some kind of benefit out of it. And even if the bill isn't brought up to a vote on the House or the Senate, when you introduce that bill, it shows intent. It shows what your actual intentions are. And if you're willing to put forward H.R. 117, Youth Voting Rights Bill, which tries to lower the voting age down to 16 years old, I wonder why they want to do that. Well, they know that an overwhelming amount of high schoolers will vote in favor of the Democratic Party. A lot of that reason is because they're indoctrinated by the Democratic Party. Number six, you have H.J. Resolution 14, which tries to abolish the Electoral College. This was written by Steve Cohen, another Democrat. Eliminating the Electoral College, guess what that does? Turns this into a national popular vote, which actually goes into number seven on my list, which is the MPVIC, which I did an entire show the other day about, and that is the states enacting laws. 17 of them have done so already for 205 total electoral votes. They only need then 65 more electoral votes. And once they do that, once enough states pass it that hold a total of 270 electoral votes, they're going to then give whichever president wins the national popular vote the state electoral votes. Which means our race goes from being an electoral college system to a national popular vote. And they can do this without needing a constitutional amendment like they would if they wanted to abolish the electoral college, because the electoral college is constitutionally mandated. By the way, they can also, using the MPVIC, which is a acronym for the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, they can put forwards this policy with less than half of the states. Whereas if they wanted to abolish the actual Electoral College because it's constitutionally mandated, they would need a constitutional amendment. To do that, they would need 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate, and they would need 75% of the states, which is 38 out of 50, to ratify that. So you tell me who's actually trying to undermine elections and sway it in their favor to have a monopoly on the presidency. Well, Michael, why would they want a monopoly on the presidency? The legislative branch is more important, right? Well, history shows that the longer you hold the presidency, then the larger changes you can make when it comes to policy, when it comes to legislative-wise, when it comes to a lot of different things. So having the presidency is very, very important. Now, it's disgusting to me that they would want to suppress any votes, but it's not surprising. The next topic on my list is Attorney General Letitia James. Attorney General Letitia James, the one that sued Trump for supposedly overvaluing his assets, and now Trump has to pay over $400 million in retribution to, does anyone know that answer? Who is he paying it to? See, no one, I haven't seen anyone actually ask that question. Where's the money that Trump would have to pay from Letitia James's lawsuit in New York going? It can't go to the banks because guess what? There was no victim. They're not even the ones that filed the lawsuit. Letitia James did. Well, Letitia James is a little power hungry now. If you didn't know, she actually successfully sued the NRA following the Trump case. And now she has filed a lawsuit against JBS Food USA Food Company. JBS is the largest beef company in the world. Here's the article, and I'll read a tweet that she posted as well today. That was pretty sickening. So it says, New York attorney Letitia James filed a lawsuit against JBS USA Food Company, the American subsidiary of the world's largest producer of beef products, for misleading the public about its environmental impact. JBS USA has claimed that it will achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2040, despite documented plans to increase production and therefore increase its carbon footprint. It says beef production emits the most greenhouse gases of any food or major food commodity, and animal agricultural accounts for 14.5% of annual global greenhouse gas emissions. So here we go. Here is our attack on food production. Let's get rid of cattle production because it emits too many greenhouse gases. Okay, I think the article, and I've talked about this on the show before, was that cow shit is what is emitting so much methane and hurting the environment. Cow shit. So let me get this straight. The cattle production is what is hurting the climate. So the solution from the left and these climate activists would be no more beef production. Well, to make beef, you have to kill the cows. So what? We're not going to kill the cows. Okay. What are we going to do with the cows? We're just going to leave them alive in the fields and let them continue to shit. So the very thing that you're blaming them for releasing too much of, methane, and hurting the climate, they can only do that when they're alive. So you want to eliminate the killing of cattle. This, right? I mean, it's a little backwards. You want to eliminate the killing of cattle so we can't feed people because they're emitting too much methane. So we want to stop killing them, let them live their life, which means that, okay, people won't be breeding them and making a larger population, right? What do you think they're going to do when people aren't breeding them? They're still going to breed. So what, we're just going to spend money to keep the bull separate from the cow, the heifers? What kind of solution is there? The other thing is a major problem with this. This is just all about control. Controlling our food, controlling where our money goes, everything. It says she's suing JBS because they misled the public about its environmental impact. No one filed a complaint against JBS. It's not like someone bought a bad pack of hamburger meat and said, oh, you know what? I can taste the carbon in this too much. I'm suing them. No, this is just Letitia James going after a major beef production company because of the advocates that pay for her to be where she's at. But she's going to sue them because they have a plan to achieve net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2040. That is in 16 fucking years. How can you sue someone for supposedly misleading the public about their climate emissions and being net zero by 2040 when it's not even 2040 yet? They haven't misled anybody. They haven't misled anybody because they didn't say they were going to be net zero by now. He said they're going to be there by 2040. How can you sue someone for not doing something that they're supposed to achieve in the future? Well, the argument against that is, well, they're supposed to be taking steps to do so. Well, sure. How do you prove what steps are going to make them climate friendly? You have to understand, okay, maybe they misled and said, we're going to have net zero carbon emissions and, our cattle production or our beef production, sorry, is going to be carbon neutral. And we're going to put these steps, in place to where it's not impacting the climate. Great. I guarantee you they have to do that if they want to even have a business in most places around the world, especially Europe. This is where the climate stuff is going way too far. Because the climate doesn't fucking matter if we can't eat. So let's just go and start financially crushing the largest beef producers in the world. Let's just get rid of that. Let's go ahead. By the way, guess what's next? And they're already doing this because they're putting in Europe, they're putting huge taxes on diesel fuel. They're putting huge regulations on farming. And you're seeing all these farmer protests over there. But once they get rid of beef production, or once they crack down on it to whatever they want, they're not going to change the carbon emissions because the cows are still going to be alive. They're not going to go out there and start culling cows for no reason. What a waste that would be, by the way, if they did that. Because we could have eaten them. Right? I mean, this is where the ass backwards shit is going on here with these people. But they're going to then find the next thing that is the largest emitter of carbon, and that's going to be traditional farming. So guess what? Can't eat your corn, well, they're not going to get rid of corn because they mix it with their oil and for your gasoline, but you know, can't eat your tomatoes, can't eat your peppers, can't eat your green beans because we can't farm them because it's emitting too much carbon. This is why these climate people are freaking crazy. The people who are putting this forward, by the way, New York, right? In the city of New York, they're so far removed from the production of food that they don't even know how it works. They don't even know how it works. This is why popular vote in the United States would be, it would be suicide for our country. Because if you had a popular vote for the presidency, guess what? You would have these climate agenda-driven people who are heavily focused in the metropolitan areas being able to monopolize the decision of who is the president for the people, the farmers in the Midwest. And these climate-driven activists that are going to be able to have full control over who's president, guess what? That president is going to enact favorable climate policies for them. And the people most impacted by those climate policies are those farmers in the Midwest. This is why we actually have a republic system to give them more weight, the people in middle America more weight. We have different economies. We have different cultures. And the founding fathers knew that mob rule was not a good thing. But going to a national popular vote, guess what? That's majority rule. That's a democracy. And that's what they wanted to avoid entirely. But now we have made it to where this Letitia James, who knows nothing about farming, nothing about beef production, I guarantee you knows nothing about the fucking climate. And I'm sorry I'm using bad language today. Usually I try to refrain from it. I'm a little fired up on this one because this is hurting our food production. This is going to hurt farmers, and you're attacking the wrong people. But she thinks she can just go start suing people to bring in revenue to the state of New York. And it's either going to go into the pockets of the illegal migrants that they're bussing in for their own political purposes, or it's going to go to, again, eventually back around to the campaigns of herself and other Democratic candidates, especially in this upcoming presidential election. It's a very corrupt system. This is the stuff we need to crack down on. It was bad enough with the Trump indictment in New York, overvaluing assets. Okay. And now you're going after a company who, for violating some kind of policy that wasn't supposed to be finished until 16 years from now. Yeah, great. We'll see how that works out. She'll probably be successful in suing them too. By the way, it's like $5,000 per infraction is what they said. And how many infractions they have supposedly committed is going to be determined in court. So she's suing them, and they don't even know if they've even committed an infraction. She's just suing them. Yes, this is all very frustrating. This all comes back to the money aspect. And I think a lot of it has to do with who's getting the money, why they want the money, and how they're going to use it. You have different factions, which is basically different interest groups. You have Letitia James, who wants to remain in power as Attorney General. You have the you know, the Biden administration who wants to keep the presidency and whoever's controlling the Biden administration, we'll just say the Democratic Party who wants to keep the presidency. You have the nonprofits who want to appear like they're doing good for people, but really they're getting money from the presidency in the form of grants to operate these campaigns and do this advocacy. There's a lot of money involved. So people are making money, people are gaining power. And one connection I want to put into this is when it comes to these illegals going to the state of New York, is I actually found that the AFL-CIO, which is a labor union that is ahead of other labor unions like the NEA and all that, they all those big labor unions, the teachers unions, the SEIU, all them pay the AFL-CIO dues. So you have members that pay the NEA dues, and then the NEA pays the AFL-CIO dues, plus members of the AFL-CIO pay dues as well. Now, what I found is the AFL-CIO actually has an incentive to fund money to these organizations that are actually shipping these migrants to New York City and these other, what do you call them, sanctuary cities. And that seems a little backwards. At first, I kind of had to wrap my head around this because why would a labor union want illegal migrants, right? Like, they want to protect their workers. Well, not really. The problem with labor unions is not that workers unionize in order to negotiate with their employers and achieve favorable benefits. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem with labor unions is that these labor unions become permanent entities, permanent due collecting entities. So for workers to want to unionize, why does a worker join a union? A worker joins a union because the union then helps them gain leverage over their employer and achieve favorable working conditions or higher salary, benefits, etc. Yet, once these negotiations are done, once a contract is signed, guess what? The labor union continues to exist and the members still continue to have to pay dues, and it could be 20 years before a new contract is signed. I always find it amazing is that, like, what's the one that... The auto workers that are on strike or negotiating their contracts right now with the big three. I have nothing against the auto workers and the members of the union. I do have a problem with the union. Why? Well, every 4 years, these contracts expire. And every 4 years, the union president comes out and talks about how their employees or the workers that are the members are getting screwed. And how these conditions are terrible. And it's always the same story. Our members are getting screwed. We need more pay. We need a day off. We need whatever. But then you look back. Well, 4 years ago, you're the one that negotiated that contract. And then you said that contractor is bad. And guess what? 4 years before that, you guys are the same entity that negotiated that contract. And it goes back almost 100 years now. So for a union to be permanent, there has to be a demand for that union to exist. Therefore, workers always have to feel like they're being screwed, because if they never felt like they're being screwed, they wouldn't have a reason to unionize. Guess what? In New York, we're just going to use New York City. The AFL-CIO, you can actually check this with their LM2 filings, has funded the importation of these migrants. In 1986, the IRCA was passed under the Reagan administration, which basically banned American businesses from hiring illegal immigrants. Now, the AFL-CIO actually supported that. But then all of a sudden, under Clinton, they went against their support for the IRCA. And they actually started to support the migrants and the hiring of migrants. Why? Well, there was a case in Washington where some migrants tried to actually unionize some agricultural workers. They tried to unionize, and guess what? The businesses in Washington fired them. So you could say, well, the AFL-CIO is just looking out for those workers. I see it differently. I say the AFL-CIO wanted these people to unionize because these people were going to pay dues. Guess what? These major labor unions, the NEA, the AFL-CIO, Sean Fain's union now, because he just had a video the other day, is overwhelmingly in support of the Democratic Party and Joe Biden. When I say overwhelmingly, I mean like 99% of all money that they give out. The NEA in 2020, by the way, gave over $150 million to the Democratic Party to help operate campaigns. The AFL-CIO, even more money than that. All of it goes to the Democratic Party. The labor unions are a source of substantial financial support when it comes to winning elections. So how does labor unions get their money? Well, they get it by collecting dues from its members. But with right-to-work states, union membership has been declining substantially. So these labor unions need to retain their power, and they do that by creating an environment that people feel like they're getting screwed. What better way to get people to unionize or join a union than importing migrant workers who people are going to say, well, they can't hire illegals. Guess what? They're saying they're asylum seekers, and if they are an asylum seeker, they're legally allowed to work. Which runs into another issue, by the way, because if they're legally allowed to work, guess what? They can also, at some point here in the near future, start applying for unemployment benefits if they don't have a job in New York City. I've already done the reading on this. That's one way that they can subsidize these migrants. But they also are probably more willing to work for lower wages because you're coming from a shit country that you were making no money. And now you're coming to New York City where you're going to make at least $15 an hour. And guess what? Well, I'm, you know, the federal minimum wage is like $7.50 or whatever it is in New York City. It's less than $15, I think. But a business is economically going to hire someone who is legally allowed to work and is willing to work for less than what like a 16, 17, 18-year-old college kid would or high school kid would. Look at Starbucks. They want to unionize. I guarantee you Starbucks was looking at hiring a lot of these migrants, and these people were like, oh, I don't want to lose my job. I want more money, and I want more security. Let's unionize. Guess what? Labor unions benefit because to unionize, you have to go through the AFL-CIO, and then that union has to pay them dues. You don't just unionize and stay separate. Those dues go to the Democratic Party. It's a win-win situation. You create this environment by busing in these people. By the way, maybe this is just a coincidence. Maybe it is. But there was an article written by Vo and by, New York Times. And it was written in December of 2023, so a couple of months ago. And the amount of asylum seekers or illegal migrants that had been shipped to New York City was between 115 and 150,000. Now, New York City, their unemployment rate, the amount that had been shipped to New York City, by the way, that was from April 2022 to as of December 2023. The November 23 unemployment report for New York City, which would have been the available data for that time, had increased 0.3% in the year 2023, but had increased around 0.4%. It had dropped from April to August in 2022. It fell a little bit, but that was coming out of COVID. So it had a consistent drop until August 2022. And then since August 2022, it had increased, I think it was around 0.4%. If you do the math and you calculate 120,000, I just went, let's go somewhere in the middle, the low end. So 120,000 divided by, which is the amount of asylum seekers that have been bussed in, divided by the total work or labor force in New York City, which was just over 4 million people. Or it's 3,990,000 because they had 3.99 million is what they had as the current labor force seasonally adjusted in New York City. That gives you 0.3%. Maybe it's just coincidental, but when you do the estimates of how many migrants have been shipped and in New York City during 2023, and you look at the unemployment numbers rise equivalent when you divide the amount of migrants into the total workforce. So you either have where some of these migrants are replacing previous New York employees, or you have a situation where they're counting these migrants as being unemployed. And if one, they're replacing some of these New York workers, then it backs up the theory that illegal migrants take jobs away from American citizens because they're willing to work for less, because that's the only reason why a worker would actually, or why a business would hire the migrant over the American, because they're getting cheaper labor. Or you have a situation where they're counting these people as being unemployed because they're now under the asylum umbrella, and they can then go and start applying for unemployment benefits. These are all things to think about. And I'm doing more research into that. I'm just saying, maybe it's just a coincidence, but that is how the math actually works out here. So there's a couple organizations that have a lot to gain, and labor unions are one of them. You create an environment where workers feel like they need to unionize to protect their jobs for any reason. And then they get more due payments. People rely on the unions more because guess what? You also have a time where unions are striking at a rate that has never really been seen before, at least not for 50, 60 years. And they're doing it under Joe Biden. They're also doing it while this migrant crisis is going on. Again, maybe coincidence, I don't know, but when you actually looked at the funding and the grants that the AFL-CIO is giving out, it's going to these organizations that are helping these migrants out. What benefit does a labor union get from helping illegal migration? They do it by trying to screw over the people of the United States, the workers of the United States, to get those, to incentivize those people to join the union. So